path to paradise begins in hell. Welcome to Banned Book Club. We're your hosts, Rafaela
and Nick.
And today we're going to be discussing Dante's Inferno by Dante Alighieri.
So first of all, I just want to say I'm really excited and actually kind of honored to be discussing this piece. This is more than just a book or a poem to me. It's something very special. Secondly, I want to acknowledge the irony here that a story about hell in all of its brutality and violence and despair, for me, ended up being one of the most positive and life-affirming things I've ever read. I mean, even if you read this book in a completely secular way, The Inferno is still the most comprehensive manual for human dysfunction. And if you really absorb this book, especially pairing it with the Purgatorio, you could probably avoid the folly of living a self-centered life and maybe even flourish. In short, it's a book that actually can change your life.
I completely agree. I've always wanted to read this book. I was always intimidated by it. I thought it was going to be too difficult. And of course, it's not a book. It's really a poem. It's a really long poem, The Divine Comedy. And so I'll give you a little background on Dante, about the Inferno, and then we'll take you through hell. So,
ooh.
I know. So about Dante and the Inferno. So if you haven't read this book, you've definitely seen it in culture today. It's heavily influenced in movies, in music. There's a video game dedicated to it.
It's so, in a Bob Dylan song.
It was in a Bob Dylan song. It's in Tangled Up in Blue. I'll let you go listen to that song and tell me where it is. So, yeah, it's a huge influential book. And now, I mean, what was it? I saw A Christmas Carol and I realized A Christmas Carol is heavily influenced by The Inferno. But
yeah, or even that Cartoon Network show they had a few years ago, Over the Garden Wall. It's a softer version of that, definitely, but there's clear inspiration.
Highly recommended. It's a short mini series. It's a Cartoon Network thing. If you're thinking it's for kids, it's really not for kids.
It's hard to overestimate Dante's impact on Western literature. I mean, a lot of people who in that field will say there's pretty much only two guys. There's Shakespeare and there's Dante. I mean, he's still taught today.
Oh, yeah.
Even in secular universities. I mean, everywhere. You can't avoid him.
Yeah, this book, I mean, is sometimes like the required reading in colleges. And actually in Italy, this book is such a big deal. Everybody has to read it. It's just overdone there. So
even the Pope, whenever it's an anniversary of some kind for Dante, he recommends everybody to read his stuff.
But of course, it's the Divine Comedy, so there is three parts to it. It's the Inferno, Purgatorio, and then Paradiso. But the most famous or the most talked about is the Inferno, and of course, it is banned.
And we should note that each of those books or parts of the poem, they're all under the umbrella of the comedy, but each one is a specific part of Dante's spiritual journey, the Inferno being hell, Purgatorio being purgatory, Paradiso being heaven. So it's this complete universe when you put them all together and read them in the way they're intended.
And, you know, originally, a little fun fact for you, it was actually just called the Commedia. So it wasn't called the Divine Comedy. It was known as that later on as it became more famous. And it's not a funny book at all. It's not called comedy because of comedy.
You know, there is one part that made me laugh. When they're in the Bulges towards the end, a demon signals for his other demons to come escort Dante and Virgil by farting. And Dante writes it as he used his ass as a trumpet.
Okay, we'll get into the Bulges and into hell. But before we get into that, so one thing that's really unique about this poem is the way it's written. So it's written in this form called terrarizza. No, Terzarima. And what
nice
that,
accent, though.
I know. I wanted to, you know, put in a little Italian. So it has this very galloping rhythm, and it's in threes. Everything's in threes, which is funny because you have threes, the Trinity, God, the Divine Comedy. So it all works together. It's just a very beautiful piece of art. So that's something unique to this poem as opposed to other poems or works of literature. But just a little bit about Dante. So he is a 13th century poet. He was exiled in 1302. So what had happened was, just not to get into a lot of history here, but in Florence, where he's from, there were these political groups, and there were these two groups called the Black Guelphs and the White Guelphs. And
is it Guelphs or Guelphs?
Guelphs, I don't know.
I think there's also Ghibellines mixed in there.
So they're fighting, and Dante gets kind of caught up in the mix, and he is banished. He's exiled from Florence.
He's actually accused of by someone he meets later in hell, I think, and calls corrupt. He's accused of grafting, which is one of the subsets of sins in the level of fraud.
Mm-hmm.
So this is – it's important because this is a very personal story for Dante. He doesn't even come up with another character. It's himself very clearly. And this whole thing is a reflection of a very real spiritual and political crisis that was going on for him and led up to his exile. And the turmoil and the pain and the hell of that is what spurred him to write this book. And I think that's really interesting.
Right. And, you know, he's physically lost and he has no home. And, you know, there's a quote in Dante's Inferno. In the middle of our journey of our life, I found myself within a dark woods where the straight way was lost. So he is a lost man.
And I just want to add really quick, I think it's so interesting that being the first line of the poem that he doesn't say in the middle of the journey of my life, it's our life. So you understand from the beginning, while this is an extremely personal story to him,
you kind of put yourself into Dante's shoes and you are experiencing hell with him.
He's branching it out to not just him, but this is everyone's struggle to go through hell and find some sort of redemption.
Right.
It's an interesting choice.
And one thing, so just to start things off. So, you know, the book opens up, or the poem opens up, and just to give you a little background on who this woman is, Beatrice. She is Dante's lost love. I mean, this is someone that he met when he was only 9 years old, and it was love at first sight. She's the epitome of perfection. She's the essence of love and beauty.
Symbol of divine grace.
Exactly. And so, you know, in the very beginning, she helps him by sending Virgil, who, you know, Virgil, what's the book? I can't pronounce it. You say it.
Well, first, we should mention that Beatrice is doing this all from heaven as an extension of God's will. She is reaching out to help Dante. And because, I mean, the book teaches you all the dynamics of how people in heaven and hell and purgatory can or can't interact with each other. But because she's from heaven, she can't even go into hell. She can't be near it by definition of her implicit perfection in heaven. So she has to send Virgil, who is the author of the Aeneid, I think is what he's most famous for, who is a shade in the uppermost level of hell with the righteous pagans. She sends him to help Dante navigate through hell and take him to purgatory, at which point he can't even continue with him.
Mm-hmm.
But
and mind you, Dante loves Virgil. So this is like,
oh yeah, think it's his personal hero.
Yeah, think of like your personal hero taking you through hell. That is what's happening with Dante. So so just to start it off, and of course, just the background, obviously this book is heavily banned because it's all about hell.
Oh, right. This is banned book club. I guess
yes.
We should have mentioned
that. Yeah, sorry. I forgot to mention. You know, this is a very dense book. So as you can see, I have all my notes here. I want to make sure I cover every point. So later on in hell, we get to the prophet Muhammad in hell. and he is having his body torn apart with his entrails out. People who are homosexuals, sodomites, they are also in hell.
Sodomites is his word.
Yeah, sodomites is his word.
A lot of scholars I've seen argue that it means a lot more than just being gay, but I mean, it's easy to see why this it would be offensive to a lot of people.
Right. And
I mean, you're in hell too. It's not going to be a PC sort of place. Before we go any further, I want to talk about the amount of structure and detail in this book for two reasons. One, every other book pales in comparison to this level of planning and detail. I mean, we were talking about Dune before. This doesn't even come close. But secondly, the structure is important because the form of the way Dante crafts hell and purgatory and heaven in these books, understanding the form itself, the way he made it, is pretty crucial to getting the points that he's making here about sin. Namely, that for Dante, there's a hierarchy to sin. And what I mean by that is, well, really, it's summed up at the beginning of the book when Dante sees purgatory when he's in the wood. He sees the mountain and he wants to go there immediately.
Mm-hmm.
But he's blocked by these three animals, the three beasts. And these three beasts are really the blueprint for Dante's whole design of hell, the structure that's so important to understanding sin. And what these beasts are, one is the she-wolf that represents incontinence, as Dante calls it. It's not the inability to keep yourself from going to the bathroom. He means it as inability to control your appetites. The second beast is the lion, which is violence. That's the middle part of hell. And the third beast is the leopard, fraud, the worst kind of sin in Dante's mind, sin that makes use of human intellect, which he sees as the highest faculty of humanity that God has given. So why you need to understand these three beasts is the three main divisions of hell, outer hell, mid hell, and lower hell, mm-hmm. are modeled after these animals. The first chunk is the she-wolf. It's the incontinent stuff. It's lust, gluttony, greed. Yeah, mm-hmm. just people who can't control or couldn't control their appetites. That's the least offensive kind of sin to Dante. And then that kind of grades into the sins of the lion in the middle level of hell. It's now you're not just out of control. It's
anger, heresy, violence.
Yeah, you have this sin in you that didn't hurt anybody else. Now you're turning it against other people in violence, murder, war, stuff like that. And then by the time you get to the very bottom, where even Satan is at the end, that is the leopard, that's fraud. It's all of the sin of the first two layers, but now added with planning, intellect, that cold, calculating element that that is what got Satan thrown out of heaven, that he planned this treachery against his creator. So that's the hierarchy of this structure in a macro sense. But Dante is so meticulous and genius that it this detail and the structure runs through down to the smallest level of the poem, even on the line level with that terza rima you were talking about. Mm-hmm. It's still, even on just the lines, it's 1, 2, 3. And that reflects the three layers of hell, the three volumes in the book, the Trinity, and everything else. So I just thought that was brilliant. And literally every detail he picks reinforces everything else in the book.
Right. And even just the way hell is shaped, I thought was really interesting. So you can think of hell as a cone. And basically it's because Satan had dropped from heaven down to the earth and broke through the core.
Crashed into
it. And so that's why he is at the very bottom. And hell gets narrower and narrower. And because of Satan falling into the earth, he basically pushed out
Yeah, the earth that he displaces from his fall ends up being the mountain of purgatory that Dante climbs in,
right.
in Purgatorio.
Then, towards the end, you know, he has to actually climb down Satan to get up to purgatory. So just a brief, you know, there are nine circles: limbo, lust, gluttony, greed, anger, heresy, violence, fraud, and treachery. So those are your worst sins. Too good. Okay, sins.
I think it's also worth noting, it's not just a bunch of rooms of people getting tortured. I mean, it is, but it has a flow. There's a progression that kind of reflects real life sin in a way that it gets worse, and as the punishments show, it more dehumanizing as you get closer to that very center. And it even heats up more towards the center. You'd think it just keeps getting hotter and hotter and hotter until you get to Satan. But after the center, the fire burns away, and things get colder and stiller, and the people, you don't even hear as much screaming talked about. It's just like you're in this vacuum almost.
One of the layers in totally closed nine off. Is complete silence. So, yeah, no, it's really interesting. Actually, my favorite part of Dante's Inferno was the ninth circle. I thought it was really cool.
Before we continue, just a quick interruption. Are you enjoying this episode? If you are, go ahead and like and subscribe. If you have anything to add to the discussion, go ahead and comment down below. Now back to the episode.
But just to start it off, we have limbo, and Virgil is taking Dante here. They're able to get in, and these are all of the people who never got to know God.
The righteous pagans.
Right. They're in intellects, you know, and
a lot of Greeks.
A lot of Greeks were there.
You got Aristotle, Plato, Pythagoras.
Diogenes.
Diogenes, even. That was really interesting to me, because you wouldn't think of Diogenes reading his biography like throwing poop at people and biting people, pretending to be a dog, that this would be a guy reserved for this nice of a place. But.
Right. And so that is your first circle, and it's really not that bad. They're not really being punished like you would think. They're just kind of stuck there.
No, it's actually, to me, it was one of the most beautiful and one of the scenes that caught me off guard the most, because it's right after they see the abandon all hope, ye who enter here sign, and they're going into hell, and you think, oh man, this is going to be so terrible. We're in hell now. But the first scene you get is these righteous pagans in limbo, and they're in this nice little citadel sort of place surrounded by soft grass. And it says even a pleasant brook. And they're not suffering. They're not happy either. And there's even a little bit of light, Dante describes, that's illuminating them. And he talks about this light as the light of human intellect, which it's interesting because intellect is a core theme for Dante here. He cares about it so much and clearly is a smart guy himself, but he shows you from the beginning in this limbo that intellect can only take you to the top of hell. It can't take you in God's presence. This is the limit of how far people could go just with peak intellect. And I thought that was so humble and interesting of an idea to put forth from such a clearly smart guy.
Right, and
but it gets so much worse after this.
It gets worse. But, you know, actually, before it gets worse, it's not as bad in lust. So in the second circle of hell, it is this never-ending wind that is just whipping these lost souls who are in love and lust, who were adulterers, who married the wrong person, who cheated.
It's the she-wolf. People couldn't control their appetites.
And Dante kind of views this sin as not as bad because it's a mutual sin. It's not like these people were in on it by themselves. It's people that were involved with each other.
It didn't hurt anyone else. He also acknowledges that it's the only sin that kind of is close to love. Mm-hmm. It's just a little, I mean, it's a warped form to him, but it's the least harmful in his eyes.
Right. And then we get to, and of course, there's a lot of famous people in there. Most notably, you have Helen of Troy there. We have Cleopatra is there. So,
And it's also worth mentioning that this is the first time in the story where Dante, it says, swoons. He's seen the suffering of these souls, and he's so overcome with compassion that he passes out.
He passes out a lot on his journey.
He does, but it's interesting to note because he really loses that compassion for these damned souls, you'll see, as he progresses. And Virgil admonishes him for it. He's kind of like, hey, what's the deal, you big baby? Like, wake up. Don't feel bad for these people.
Right, and it makes you wonder, like, should he have pity or should he sympathize for these people he encounters in hell?
Well, by the end of it, I think in the middle is when he goes from no longer swooning to actually asking Virgil if he can dunk someone's head down into the river Styx for fun. And then there's a pretty rough scene in the ninth circle, the frozen level, where he rips the hair out of a guy's head who's being punished down there. And it almost seems as if he enjoys it. But Virgil tells him that it's a virtuous thing to not only not have sympathy for these people, but kind of hate them. And I think what he's saying is to be righteous, you have to hate sin. I didn't know how I felt about that. I mean, that was pretty hard for me to process. But I think I get the idea that Dante was going for it. That, like we talked about Beatrice in the beginning, she can't be around evil. If you're good, mm-hmm. you have to hate the bad.
Right. And then we get to 3, gluttony. And this is where it is just raining constantly. There is excrement everywhere. People are just eating and throwing up and, you know.
They're buried in this sludge. Mucousy snow, and they're guarded over by Cerberus, who, if he sees them pop out of the snow, he just rips them up.
Right. And
that, he, Cerberus himself, is in the embodiment of this ravenous hunger. Everything is an allegory in here.
Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Before we continue, a quick interruption. Want to purchase the book we're discussing in this episode? Well, check out Bookshop. Bookshop is an online bookstore with a mission to financially support local independent bookstores. As more and more people buy their books online, Bookshop has created an easy, convenient way for you to get your books and support bookstores at the same time. Bookshop will give away over 75% of their profit margin to stores, publications, and authors. If you want to shop the books we've covered on the podcast, visit the link down below in the description. We do receive a small commission based on sales, so thank you for all your support of our channel and podcast.
Yeah, and I think one thing you'll see as we go through each layer is, you know, does this punishment fit the sin or the crime? You know, and it seems like with people that were lustful, you know, they're being whipped by the wind forever and ever, or people that are gluttonous, you know, they're having to basically eat and throw up for eternity. It just feels like Dante kind of got it. Or being eaten. Yeah, it almost feels like Dante, you know, had a point behind all of this, and maybe it does fit the crime. But we'll explore that question again as we dive deeper. So I thought greed was an interesting level. It wasn't so much as, you know, them being whipped by demons or tortured, but they're kind of torturing themselves. They are people that are working hard for the money and people that, you know.
Well, you're talking about the hoarders and the wasters, right?
Yes. And they're just pushing these boulders at each other.
Yeah, that's an interesting point, because there isn't some kind of evil monster in this level that's torturing them, or a wind blowing them around. This is the first time you see the denizens of hell actually kind of participating in their own suffering or inflicting suffering on each other. If they would just stop shoving this giant rock back and forth, the hoarders and the wasters, they wouldn't be getting run over by it, and presumably nothing would happen to them. I mean, I'm sure they would, but it's an interesting device. I think Dante was trying to show, you know, these people are just stuck in this sin. It's something that they've made a part of their will. It's almost like they put themselves there in this situation because part of them wants it. I think Virgil, when Dante brings up this question to him, says something like, they yearn for what they fear.
Right, and I think that's the most interesting part about this whole story is they can get out of hell. They just have to stop. They just have to stop doing what they're doing, and they will be saved. And I just find that so interesting because it's not like they're, well, I guess the book does open up with abandon all hope, ye who enter here. But these people could have some hope if they would just stop participating in their sin. But they're just doing it over and over and over again. And Virgil explains that to Dante that, you know, they could get out, but they actually enjoy doing this.
Yeah, I mean, I think there you might get into a theological debate that I don't know if we have time for, but that's kind of like what C.S. Lewis said in his stance on hell, that it's a door that's locked from the inside. Mm-hmm. Basically, God doesn't send you there, you put yourself there. And, you know, that might sound kind of heavy-handed religiously, but again, you have to step back and look at this as an allegory for dysfunction in people's lives. And if you look at, you know, in a secular way, dysfunction in people on earth, it is something you do to yourself. I mean, no one has control but you. And you see yourself in these different people suffering on these levels, and it's like you're looking in the mirror, like people just self-destructing from their own will.
It's like we were talking about this the other day. So St. Augustine, you know, he says this very famous line of being incurvatus in se, which means to be caved in on oneself. And that's what this sin or these sins are. It's basically caving in around yourself. And as you're getting lower and lower into hell, everything's getting
literally
narrower.
caving in.
It's getting narrower. And I mean, you can think of your life in that way. So, you know, you can ask yourself, like, how am I getting my life into this, you know, narrow path? How do I get myself out of there? And so I just thought that was a cool line, like to be caved in on oneself. Then we have anger as level 5, and that is people fighting in the River Styx, and they just keep fighting for eternity. Heresy, flaming tombs, violence, you know, they're in a river of blood. There's 3 layers to this. And
I thought the river of blood was the Phlegethon, and the Styx was like a yucky black marsh or something where the wrathful and the sullen people were.
Are you talking about anger?
Yeah, or wrath.
All I have here is that they were in the River Styx, and they're basically drowning for eternity.
Okay. There's a lot of rivers.
There are a lot of rivers.
That he takes care to show. This might be kind of a cheesy leap, but I thought that was trying to show, like, the river to hell just flows down and down, and you follow this one path that takes you through all this stuff.
Right. And so as you see, things start to get worse in these levels. So anger, heresy, violence, people are being tortured. This is where all the fire really is. You know, rivers of blood, people drowning, people being tormented by demons, being eaten by snakes, and all of these horrible things are happening to them. And then as you get deeper into hell, you have fraud and treachery, which I thought was really interesting that that's what Dante saw as the worst types of sin. And of course, like you said, with the
leopard,
the beasts, the leopard, you know, these are people that were conscious of their sin. You know, people that, you know, I thought it was interesting that there's a difference between fraud and treachery, even though they sound the same. So fraud, like pretending to be someone you're not, like, for example, let's say that you are a corrupt, you know, church figurehead, you know, and you're hurting others, or you're really pretending to be someone you're not. But then if you are a friend to someone and then you, like, for example, Judas betraying Jesus, you know, that is the worst type of sin. Like something that hurts another is going to be a worse sin than being a fraud.
Yeah, and it the structure was a little overwhelming for me in the beginning. I didn't understand totally why he had done that, but looking back on it now, it makes so much sense, because the sins of fraud at the end are, if you think about it, they're really just a progression of the sins from the beginning. So he's saying corruption is a process, right? Nobody comes out of the womb and immediately they're committing treachery against their best friend. It starts with you lose a little bit of control, then you're doing the lion stuff, then you're doing the leopard stuff. I mean, this is a really cheesy example, but I mean, it's just like in real life. Let's compare it to something like drugs. You start off just kind of flirting with the idea. You're doing it. You're still going to work, maintaining everything.
Oh, it's not so bad. It just helps take the edge off.
Yeah. And then you start to lose a little bit of your control for your appetite. And
what's a little coke?
And then next, maybe, I don't know, you're beating someone up so you can get money for drugs.
I had to do
that. And then after that, your family's starting to leave you. You betray your best friend.
I didn't need a family.
Break into his house and steal his china to sell it for money. I don't know. It's a dumb example, but it's true.
It like just snowballs,
real,
yeah.
Real life reflects this process of snowballing dysfunction. I mean, even in philosophies that aren't Western at all, like Eastern stuff, like the most watered down version is probably Star Wars. Like, fear leads to anger. Anger leads to hate. Hate leads to suffering. I mean, that's why this stuff is important, mm-hmm. even outside of a religious context. And I mean, we're talking about fraud. That brings us to really the fruits of letting this sort of corruption go hog wild in your life. And that is the frozen lake at the bottom of hell.
I think it's really interesting that, you know, the lower we go, the colder it gets, and that's really what sin is like. I mean, it's lonely, it's isolating, it's narrowing.
At first, it's all
you just feel stuck.
Fire and passion and all this big gaudy stuff. But he does an interesting move, and he pulls that out kind of in the middle, mm-hmm. and it starts getting blacker and just quieter and darker in the Bulgia stuff. And then finally you get to where Satan lives, in this frozen, quiet, cut off place. And it made me think about something, that the relationship between good and evil, as Dante describes it, is a lot like the relationship between heat and cold.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, in science, there is no such thing as cold. Cold is just an absence of heat, mm-hmm. heat being the motion of energy-charged atoms. It's not cold is not a thing on its own. It doesn't exist on its own. It's just the absence of heat. Just like Dante shows us in the story, evil is not a thing on its own. It's just a absence of good, or a twisting of things that were inherently good, and mm-hmm. seeing them in these weirdo reflected forms. I mean, it's so powerful when you finally get to Satan himself, because if you know a little bit about Christian doctrine, the way that Dante portrays Satan is kind of this sick parody of the three-person Trinity. He's got three faces.
And he's just chewing and gnawing on bodies. So he has, oh my gosh, he has Brutus, right? And he has Judas in the middle of his mouth.
Also Cassius, I think, is the third one.
So people that betrayed Caesar are on the sides, and they're being chewed. But then dangling out of his mouth is Judas, and he is just gnawing on him. He has six eyes, and he's just crying the whole time. He's just crying blood. And he's drooling, and he doesn't speak. He doesn't say one word. He is flapping his wings, too, and he's making hell so cold.
And
so,
he's no different than any of the other sufferers that we were talking about, like the greed people or the people who are fighting in the river of blood. If he would just stop flapping his wings, he could thaw out of that lake mm-hmm. and get out of there. But he can't. And It's interesting to contrast this image of Satan with probably the most famous other image of Satan we get in literature, in Paradise Lost, where Milton shows him as this kind of sexy, heroic, cool guy that you really sympathize with in the beginning. But Dante shows him as just completely pathetic.
Yeah, and he's sad. It's a sad thing.
And almost you get the vibe that he's kind of dumb. He doesn't even notice it when Virgil and Dante hop on his back.
And they're climbing down. And you would think like there would be this big battle, like Satan was going to fight them. And no, that's not what this is all about. It's just showing you that you can actually disempower sin. And it's very powerful.
If you're willing to go through all this and look at the reality of it and reflect on what parts of that dysfunction are unattended inside mm-hmm. yourself. But that's why he can't just go straight to purgatory from the first line. He has to go through this transformation.
Yeah, and like you said, just building off of what you were talking about before, I wanted to jump in there. You know, the colder hell is, it's just not as dramatic as you would think it is. It's not full of passion. It's completely immobile. Everything is frozen. There are people just frozen in the ice. And of course, you have Satan frozen in the ice. And, you know, this scares Dante a lot. He's trembling at how awful it all is. So he's finally really coming to terms with all this. And I thought it was interesting where he's really scared to jump on Satan and jump down. And Virgil explains, hold tight. There is no other way. And of course, he tried to go straight to purgatory. He tried to climb the mountain. But like we opened up the podcast with, or the episode with, is, you know, the path to paradise begins in hell. He has to go through this. He has to basically be faced with the worst sin of all to truly understand.
Yeah, and it seemed to me like Dante there was suggesting something I've heard from Soren Kierkegaard, who's this kind of Christian-y, not exactly, but existentialist philosopher. And he says you can't really believe in anything unless you've suffered through it and felt through it. And I think that's the exact same sentiment that this book is giving you here at the end. He wouldn't have been able to climb down Satan's back and get through the center of the earth to purgatory any other way than this.
Right. It makes you, I mean, after reading this book, it makes you take a long, hard look at your life. I mean, Dante wrote this in his midlife crisis, and everybody has to go through some kind of crisis in their life for them to truly change. Or maybe you're just perfect and awesome the whole time. But most 9 times out
probably
of 10,
not.
Yeah, you have to basically find yourself in the pit to really wake up and say, okay, what am I doing with my life? I've got to dig myself out of this hole. And so I think this book is really life-changing for a lot of people. And it makes you wonder, what circle of hell would you be in?
I was thinking about this question while I was reading the book, and I would have to be in all of them at the same time.
I don't understand why you say that.
I mean, I don't know who I think at least Dante was seeing that he had all these sorts of sins mm-hmm. in his life at once. I mean, that's what's so impressive about his work here is it captures
right.
every type of problem you deal with.
Everybody's
as a human.
Probably so, sinned one of these things.
I mean, maybe the God in Dante's universe would, I mean, obviously he's smarter than me and he would probably pick some defining sin of my life and I'd probably end up in one of the lower circles. But
I know, I'm worried I'd be in fraud.
I'd have to be in gluttony, in all of them at the same time.
Probably greed, too.
They'd have to make copies of my body and just torture all of them.
You're just like falling down, up and down. You're going through everything. It's horrific. I asked this earlier, does the punishment fit the crime? And I truly think so. And I know that...
Really?
I think so. I think
a lot of people would say that's a pretty harsh stance there.
It's a harsh stance, but it all made sense to me. And look at real life today. I mean, a murderer or a felony, you know, is much worse of a crime than someone who, you know, got caught cheating.
Well, now we're getting kind of into philosophy, but I mean, if you're taking this as a literal view of hell, most people's objection to that is, why do you get an infinite punishment for a finite crime? But Dante has an answer to that. I mean, if you're just working with the logic of this universe, he says something along the lines of, you've offended something that's infinitely good, God. Mm-hmm. So,
and made it your own and thought about yourself and made that weird parody.
Yeah, you like tried Satan, you tried to be your own God, and I guess there is no limit to how much you should be punished for offending a limitless being. So, I don't know. I mean, I don't know enough about Dante, unfortunately, to know his stance on the actual nuts and bolts of how he thinks hell works.
Right.
But again, you don't have to read this book that way if you don't want to. And you can just look at it as, if I don't try to fix the flaws in myself, they could really get worse.
You can't just be content in that sin.
No.
Well, just to close this episode out, you know, unfortunately when Dante died, you know, he never actually returned back to Florence.
He stayed in exile?
He was in exile. He died in Ravenna, and he's actually buried there. So he actually never went home. And even Florence, they want to bring him there and bury him there. But no, if you can have Dante in life, you can't have him in death. So I thought that was pretty cool.
One of the biggest takeaways I had from this book was, if you look at what it really is, this is the ultimate Dark Night of the Soul book. I mean, we have plenty of these. We've covered a lot of them on our channel. Mm-hmm. But it can't get worse than this. This is hell.
I know,
and
right?
And like not some weird floaty metaphor of hell, like actual...
We are in hell.
In hell. It can't get more Dark Night of the Soulier than this. But the takeaway for me is it's also ending on such an optimistic note, or just the underlying message is so optimistic. It's... He's saying that, you know, this sin, these problems of human nature are a reality that you can't get around. But if you use your mind and your will, you can fix yourself, and not for the point of just avoiding eternal punishment, but you can make yourself into a flourishing kind of person while you're alive if you do the opposite of this stuff and go through the work that Dante mm-hmm. goes through in purgatory. And again, if you're running with this big extended metaphor, if you recognize this stuff and go through the work to fix it, then you've actually become kind of perfect by the end. And I mean, that's when Dante is ascended up into heaven, because right. not because of some magic trick or because he said a prayer one time and he had faith, because he actually remade himself. And that, I think that's...
He was willing to change.
Yeah, and I think that's universal to everyone, that we all have that hope and the agency to take charge of our lives and lift ourselves up higher to what we could be.
And that's what's nice about the ending of Dante's Inferno as opposed to something like American Psycho, which we've covered on the podcast. You know, it ends with, this is not an exit. All hope is lost. Dante's takes a
lighter
turn.
And it starts, too, interestingly enough, with abandon all hope, ye who enter here, is written in red on the whatever.
Nice going,
on Chemical
Brett.
Bank. Yeah, but instead of leaving you in the void,
Dante shows you that there is a way out. And
yeah,
that's what
I mean,
think is beautiful.
What could be more perfect than that? And it's not cheesy at all.
No, it's not. Well, thank you so much for watching. If you're here on YouTube, make sure you like and subscribe. It really helps the algorithm of YouTube so our videos can pop up to the top. So please comment if you have any thoughts to share about Dante's Inferno. If you're listening on Apple Podcasts or Spotify, be sure to like it, give us a 5-star review, and make sure you follow us on social media. We're on Instagram, Facebook, Twitter, so message us anytime if you have any suggestions for us. And remember,
if a book is banned it's worth reading.